you're with us this morning, and we hope that you'll find this helpful as we talk about this important subject. If you're with us for the first time, we want to give a special welcome to you, and I want to just relax, okay, because I want you to know something. We do not want something from you, but we do want something for you. And that's why we're in the middle of this series. Now, our series is entitled Be Rich, because we saw last week in 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul has a special message for rich people. And now I know that none of us are rich. I understand that. I do. But if you ever do become rich, I want you to be good at it. Okay, so that's kind of where we're going with this subject. That's what this series is about. And last week, we saw that Paul told the people, told rich people, command those who are rich in this present world to do good and to be rich in good deeds and be generous and willing to share. So we're talking about this in the event that any of us ever should become rich. If that should happen, we want you to be good at it. Because most rich people, quite frankly, aren't good at being rich. They're bad at it. As a matter of fact, generally, I don't know if you know this, but generally, the more money a person makes, the less they give. The more money a person makes, the less proportionately they give away. The dollar amount might be bigger, okay? I understand that. But the percentage amount, many times, is smaller. It shrinks. And that's why Jesus was never impressed by people who gave a large amount of money, but he always emphasized percentage giving. One day, he's at the entrance of the temple. You know this story well, those of you who have been around church any length of time. He's at the entrance of the temple where people would drop in their offering. And some people would make a big show of what they were given because they were giving large amounts and large gifts. And Jesus is sitting there watching them. And Mark tells us that many rich people threw in large amounts. But Jesus sits there unimpressed. And then a poor widow comes forward, and she puts two small coins into the offering. Worse, less than a penny today. Two small coins. And Jesus sees this, and he calls his guys together. He says, come over here. Come over here. I want you to come over here. See that lady? See that lady? I tell you the truth. This poor widow has put more into this treasury than all of the others. Because they gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything that she had to live on. You see, it wasn't the size of the gift that matters. It's the proportion of the gift. Now, you know, I know that a lot of people, they say, Pastor, I'd love to be more generous. As a matter of fact, I pray, I ask God, please make me more generous. And generally what we mean by that when we're praying that prayer is generally we're saying, God, what I want you to do is give me a lot more money. Because if I have a lot more money, then I'll be more generous. We were at a conference this week, Steve and Hannah and Jason and I were at a conference up in Buckhead. Jeff Henderson was the speaker, and Jeff Henderson said something that those of us in ministry are quite aware of. Jeff said, you know, he said, I told God at one point, he said, I'll never be in church ministry, because he was a preacher's kid. And I got to tell you, I understood that right away, because I said, I will never be a pastor. Now, some of you are convinced I've made that, but hey, what can I say? So Jeff says, he said, I told God I never, and he said, here I am now serving in church for 10 years. And Jeff said, so I got this great idea. He said, I told God, God, I'll never be a billionaire. Let me see what he does with that. I don't know why I didn't think of that. But we have this idea that if we get more, then then we will give more. But you know what? You're not going to do it. If you don't give now, you're not going to give then. If you're not giving from what you already have, you won't give from what you get. You know how I know that? Because here's the thing. The more you receive, the more you'll need it. The more you receive, the more you'll need it. And it doesn't matter what you're doing sometime in the future, you will always find a need to keep what you have, whether it's large or small. And studies have shown that the more Americans make, the less they give proportionately. The more Americans make, the less they give proportionally. So today we want to talk about this subject, because if you ever do become rich, if your boat ever does come in, I want you to be a good rich person. So we're back in 1 Timothy chapter 6. If you have your Bible, you might want to turn there. If you don't have a Bible, there's one in the chair in front of you. You can look it up there, or you can look up here on the screen, and we'll put it up there for you as well. Paul says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Now, here's what we want to talk about today. Wealth, money, has side effects. You ever notice that? You know, you see some rich people, and you know, they're kind of odd. And you wonder, you know, were they odd before they got rich, or did they get rich and become odd? And one of the side effects of wealth is that rich people live in denial. Did you know that? Rich people live in denial. I've known some rich people over the years. I used to be in mission work for many, many, many years, and I had people that supported us, and some of them were quite well-to-do. And so I've known some rich people over the years, and I will tell you this, not one of them would ever admit that they were rich. Not one of them. No matter how much we have, there's always someone who has more. So here's the bottom line, nobody's rich, but everybody knows somebody who is, right? You know, people who made $30,000 a year were asked, are you rich? And they said, no, we're not rich. And they said, how much would you have to make a year to be rich? And they said, well, we think if we made about $75,000 a year, we'd be rich. So then they went and they asked people who made $75,000 a year, do you think you're rich? And the people who made $75,000 a year said, no, we're absolutely not rich. They said, how much do you think you would need to be rich? And these people said, we need about $150,000 a year to be rich. And then Money Magazine did a survey of those who are subscribers to it. So, you know, I don't think any of us are subscribers to Money Magazine. But they did a survey of their subscribers, and they said, what do you think a person would have in order to be considered rich? You ready for this? Here was their answer. Money Magazine subscribers, they said that a person would have $5 million in liquid access before they would be rich. So you can have $1 million and you're not rich. You can have $2 million and you're not rich. You can have $3 or $4 million and you're not rich. But when you hit $5 million, suddenly you're rich. But here's what I know. If you ask somebody who's making $5 million or who had $5 million in liquid access, if they're rich, they're going to say, no, I'm not rich. Because the line keeps changing. It's elusive. It keeps changing. And we either don't realize we're rich, or we don't believe we're rich, and so we don't know how to act. Okay, here's an interesting thing. Did you know, if you're here today, I'm not going to ask you to raise hands. If you're here today and you make $40,000 a year in salary, do you know that that puts you in the top 4% of income in the world? That's the reaction I expected. Do you know that if you make $48,000 a year, you're in the top 1% income of the world. So you see, most of us are rich, but we're not going to admit it. We're going to say, you know, okay, I might be rich as far as the world is concerned, but I don't live in the world. I live in America, and I'm just average in America. So when I said those of you who make $40,000 a year are in the top 4%, not one of you jumped up and said, yay, honey, we're rich. Did you hear that? We're rich. Yoo-hoo! Man, I can't believe it. I'm rich and I didn't even know it. No, you didn't even react. And you know why you didn't react? Because you don't feel rich. You don't feel rich. And because you don't feel rich, you don't know how to act. The second effect that wealth brings is discontentment. Denial and discontentment. Rich people are plagued by discontentment. Because you see, the accumulation of stuff is like an appetite. And what happens when you feed an appetite? It grows. And when you starve an appetite, it shrinks. And like appetites, one of the things you have to realize is this: appetites are never fully or finally satisfied, are they? The more they get, the more you want. That's just the way it is. Andrew Carnegie was one of the richest men of the 19th century. He made his billions in the steel industry. But Andrew Carnegie was never happy with the money that he had, ever. And do you know why? He was never happy because John D. Rockefeller, or contemporary, was always just a little bit richer than he was. And that made Carnegie miserable. Kid you not. Amazing, amazing thing. The wisest and unquestionably the richest man of his day was King Solomon. According to the ancient records, his wealth was so great that critics of the Bible doubt that the man even existed. They say there's no way that this guy could have existed. According to the Bible, his yearly salary... Tell me how many of you could live on this. His yearly salary was 25 tons of gold a year. And his everyday dishes were pure gold. That's what he ate off of every day. And Ezra, the author of 2 Chronicles, tells us that according to Jewish tradition, it says King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all of the other kings of the earth. You know, we like music. Most of us like music. I heard a story about Myra on this Women of Faith conference that I'm not going to share, but she proved that she really liked Third Day. But we love music. So what do? We go out and we buy CDs or we download from the iTunes store, you know, kind of get it. King Solomon didn't do that. Not because music wasn't recordable, okay? Even if it was recordable, he probably would have done it. You know, when King Solomon saw a band that he liked, you know what he did? He went out and bought the band. He just didn't rent them for the night. He bought them. He owned them. He was like the first music magnate to ever live. That's what he did. He had that type of money. And the smartest, richest man who ever lived said, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. That line keeps changing. Just a little more, just a little more, just a little more. And you know people like that, don't you? Rich people live in denial. They're not rich. And the more you have, the more you want. Never satisfied. So rich people, and that includes many of us who think we're not rich, do a strange thing. Even those of us who say, you know, hey, there's no way I'm rich. Not at least by American standard. I know what you said about the world. But by the real life, I'm not really rich. And so here's what we do. We take something that's perfectly good, and when the new version of it comes out, we go and sell that which is perfectly good to get the newer model. That's why you have all these people standing in front of the Apple store texting on their iPhone 5. I am standing here in front of the Apple store. Guess what? I'm getting ready to buy an iPhone 5S. Woohoo! Or why you'll take a perfectly good car and some cash and go into the dealership and leave your car and leave your cash and drive out with another vehicle that does exactly the same thing your last one did. But you're happy because, well, at least for a couple of days, or maybe a week, or maybe you're, you know, really kind of happy until the bill comes. But it's amazing what we do that. Why is that? Because appetites grow. And as we acquire things, we begin to close our hands around them. We don't live this way, open-handed. We begin to close our hands, and we begin to hoard. You know, you've seen it expressed on the bumper sticker, right? The one who has dies with the most toys, what? Wins. You knew that. See that? Now, that's a lie, by the way. But the problem is, most of us seem to live as if we believe that lie. And the more a person has, the more that person wants. That's why you get a rich person. You put them in a closet, you know, this as big as my bedroom, full of clothes. And they say, what? I don't have anything to wear. I don't have anything to wear. Now, they've got work clothes, and they got after-work clothes, and they've got workout clothes, and they've got work-in-the-garden clothes, but I ain't got nothing to wear. The more we have, the more we want. And so the letter that the Apostle Paul writes to young Timothy goes right to the heart of this problem. In the passage, he's writing to rich people in the church, but it applies to rich people everywhere. And here's what he says: command those who are rich in this present world. Now, that word command means give them some instructions. Tell them how to be good rich people is what he's going to do. Now, if you had a chance to tell a rich person something, what would you tell them? Well, look at what he says: command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant. Not to be arrogant. Have you ever noticed how some rich people are really full of themselves? You ever noticed that? And you know, to be fair, we do it to them. You know, we get around a rich person, and all of a sudden we start to fawn all over them. We start to listen. You know, everything that they say is a golden nugget from their lips. Oh, you are so smart. You got so much money. And what happens is this: the rich person begins to think that he is smarter, or she is smarter than everybody else. And the reason they think that they're smarter than everybody else is because they have more than anybody else. And then it is one small step from thinking that I'm smarter than everybody else to beginning to believe that I am better than everybody else. Tell the rich people, don't be arrogant. Don't be arrogant. So Paul says to these early believers, hey, if you're rich, first thing, don't let it go to your head. Don't let it go to your head. And then he goes to the heart of the problem. First he deals with the head, now he's going to deal with the heart of the problem. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. Now, this is a big thing. Because what Paul is telling us, that as your financial health increases, many times your spiritual health decreases. And that's not a purposeful thing. But if you don't plan for it, it's going to happen. And the reason for this, again, is not a conscious decision that you make. But as your bank account begins to grow, many times your hope begins to migrate. And your hope begins to migrate towards the accumulation of things and wealth. So he writes and warns us, don't let your hope migrate and get so wrapped up in your wealth and the things that you can accumulate. That's a terrible thing, he says, to let happen to you. So make up your mind now that if you ever get rich, get financially secure, make up your mind that you will not let your hope move from God over and his blessings over to what you have and your accomplishments. Because it will happen if you don't plan for it, if you don't watch out for it. So back to Solomon. Solomon, the wisest man who ever wrote, said this, the wealth of a rich man is a fortified city. They imagine it as an unscalable wall. They imagine it because it's not true. They imagine it because it's a pipe dream. They imagine it because it's a vapor. It's here 1 minute and it's gone the next. And they imagine it because they are deceived. They imagine that it's a wall too high to scale, an unscalable wall. And here's what he's saying. When you begin to accumulate things, there comes a point when you begin to think that your wealth is so much, that your financial portfolio is so secure, that as it grows, there's going to come a time when you will be safe. You'll be able to protect your assets no matter what happens. You'll be able to protect your family no matter what happens. You'll be able to protect your grandkids. And maybe even the next generation, you'll be able to check your great-grandchildren. And we begin to think at that point that somehow we can save our way to safety. And in the process, our hope shifts from someone to something. Now, I'm going to help you with this. So let me ask you a question. I want you to think about it. Don't answer this out loud, Steve. But I want you to think about this. How much money would you need in order to secure your future against all imaginable eventualities? How much money would you need to secure your future against all imaginable eventualities? How much money would you have to have in order that you could live fearlessly, that you could live comfortably without worries and concerns? So that nothing could touch you, or nothing could touch your immediate family, or nothing could touch your grandchildren who you love, or maybe even your great-grandchildren. How much money would it take? How much do you need to save in order to be safe that no matter what happens to our economy or what happens to our nation, you say, I'm cool. How much would it take? Now, I know the answer, by the way, for you. You know I do magic, so you know I do some mind reading, right? But I know the answer. I'm going to give it to you. But I want you to think about it just for a minute. How much would it take to make you feel, I am safe. I don't have any more worries. Are you ready? Here's the answer. More than you currently have. More than you. It's always going to be more than you currently have. It's just the way it's going to be. Because here's what happens. As your wealth begins to grow, you start saying, but what if? What if this happens? What if that happens? What if this transpires? What if? Do you know, and this is just a fact, do you know that poor people are often far more generous than rich people? Like that widow in our story. And do you know why that is? I'll tell you why it is. Because poor people never place their hope in wealth because they don't have any. Poor people know that they're not going to be able to save their way into safety. They know it. So if you ask a poor person to give you something or to loan you something, chances are they're going to do it because they live life with open hands. They know, you know, hey, my $10 isn't going to secure my future. Sure, I'll give it to you. I don't know what I'm going to eat tonight, but I'll give it to you. They know that that $10 isn't going to be able to save their way to safety or save their way into security. But the rich person, whose heart has begun to migrate towards their wealth, they deceive themselves into thinking that they can buy their way into security, and somehow they can reach a magic number that once they have it, they will be like a fortified city and an unscalable wall. And nothing will be able to touch them. And they deceive themselves into thinking, if I have just a little more, I'll be able to sit back and say, I'm safe. I'm secure. I don't have a worry in this world. But you know what? You'll never reach that magic number. Earlier, we were talking about Andrew Carnegie being upset that John D. Rockefeller had more than him. When John D. Rockefeller started gaining his millions, at his first million, a newspaper, and this was tremendous back in the 1800s, $1 million in the 1800s, a newspaper reporter goes to Mr. Rockefeller and they say, Mr. Rockefeller, you are the first millionaire in America. First millionaire in America. Are you satisfied? Are you a happy man? And John D. Rockefeller said, no, I'm not happy, and I'm not satisfied. And he said, well, Mr. Rockefeller, he said, what would it take to make you happy, and what would it take to make you satisfied? And Mr. Rockefeller said, it would take one more million. That's all, one more million. A year later, Mr. Rockefeller, because he did Shell Oil Company, had that 1 million. The reporter went back to him again and said, Mr. Rockefeller, you now have $2 million. Are you satisfied? And Mr. Rockefeller said, no, I'm not satisfied. I'm not happy. He said, well, Mr. Rockefeller, what is it that will take you to make you satisfied, to make you happy? And Rockefeller said, one more million. One more million. When you start putting your hope in wealth, it is always going to be, I need just a little more. One more dollar, two more dollars, five more dollars, a million more dollars. But when you start believing that, you think that you can get that way and you can be safe. And the reason for it is because if you feed an appetite, the appetite grows. You always need more. It's always bigger. It always wants more. If you allow your hope to swing towards your wealth, here's what happens. When wealth becomes your hope, you will begin to hoard. When wealth becomes your hope, you will begin to hoard. You just will. You'll never have enough. And you will never be generous. And you know why? Because you'll always be saying, but what if? And you'll give a little here, and you'll give a little there, and you'll go to a charity, and they'll wine and dine you. Sorry, I probably shouldn't say that because we're in a Baptist church. They'll coke and dine you. And you'll give a show-off gift. You know, it might be a pretty big, sizable gift, but it's really not generous. It's not what you could do. And the reason you're not generous is because you can't afford to be generous because you are busy building that unscalable wall, that fortified city that's going to protect you and your family and your grandchildren and your grandchildren and the great-grandchildren. So you can't afford to be generous. And you start saying, what if, what if, what if? And what's happened is your hope has migrated from God to your wealth, to your bank account. And as your wealth increases, you think that you'll be more generous, but you're not, because your hands will begin to close, because you'll be saying, what if? What if? and you have placed your hope and security and all your eventualities and what might happen, and so you begin to hoard. And you put your hope in the wrong things. You didn't make a conscious decision for it to happen. It just happened. And you don't know how it happened. And Paul goes on to say, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Now, I got to pause here and say, I know that some of you are saying, typical pastor, talking about money again. All you pastors ever do is talk about money. And it's not true. We don't always talk about money. And those of you who know me know that I maybe do this maybe once a year, generally. But you know why pastors talk about money? It's not what you think. Do you know why we talk about money? I'll tell you why we talk about money. The reason we talk about money is because Jesus talked about money. As a matter of fact, you may not know this, but Jesus talked more about money than he did about heaven or hell. Probably four times more about money than he ever did about heaven or hell. And do you know why Jesus talked about money and not heaven and hell as much? Because Jesus knew that the chief competitor for God, for your heart, is your money. That's the chief competitor that God has. You know, people aren't running around saying, okay, let me figure this out. Should I follow God? Should I follow Satan? Should I follow God? Should I follow? I don't know which one. Is it Christmas or Halloween? I don't know. We don't do that. But when it comes to money, we don't see it. And it kind of sneaks in there. And Jesus said, you can't serve God and money. And the reason he said you can't serve God and money is because he said where your treasure is, what you value in life, that is where your heart is going to be. And that's what happens, isn't it? When we start treasuring our possessions, wealth becomes a substitute for God. Wealth becomes a substitute for God. And some of us, frankly, because we said this right at the beginning, you don't consider yourself rich. But I know this, your heart has already started to migrate to the things you already have. Solomon wrote, keep falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I might have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and dishonor the name of God. You see, Solomon understood that there's an amount of wealth that can so affect you, so influence you, that you'll forget God. Who's the Lord? I used to be a Christian, but who's the Lord? I used to be involved in church, but who's the Lord? I used to believe that stuff, but you know what? Who is the Lord? And you will never realize that it was your possessions that drove the wedge between you and your relationship with God. And wealth will become a substitute for God. Now, I want to help you in this. Help you figure out where you stand. Say, you know, I don't know where, Pastor, I don't think my heart has begun to migrate. So I'm going to give you two statements. Okay? We've done this before with some of you. And I want you to ask yourself, I want you to be honest with yourself with these two statements. I want you to admit which statement causes more anxiety for you, causes you to worry more. Okay? So the first statement is this: there is no God. There is no God. That's it. You know, this life is all there is. When you die, you're dead. You're warm food. You don't know anything. Nobody knows you. No heaven, no hell, no judgment. It's over. There is no God. No purpose, no meaning in life. This is all there is. It's simply gone. Does that cause a lot of anxiety in you? Or does this statement cause more anxiety into you? You have no money. It's gone, all of it. You can't get it back. You're at zero, and Larry Burkett's not going to help you. I guess it's Howard Dayton now, isn't it? Okay. Which one creates more anxiety in you? And while you're thinking about this and maybe starting to feel good about yourself, let's put it in perspective. Now imagine those same two questions, but this time you're laying in a hospital bed hooked up to all kinds of machines. And the doctor comes in and they say, you know, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you don't have long to live. Now, which of those two statements becomes more important to you? Wherever your hope was before, when it comes to the possibility of death, I guarantee you that suddenly your questions are going to turn towards that first statement. There is no God. Your question is going to be, where will I spend eternity? Will I see my loved ones again? Will there anyone be there waiting for me? And when you face the reality of your mortality, and one day you will, suddenly, there is no God. That's going to be the most important question for you. Is there a God? Is what we read in the Bible true? Can I believe in this one who rose from the dead? Is that accurate? So what Paul is saying to us is real simple. If you are going to put your hope in God in the end, when there's nothing you can do to change what's coming, if you're going to put your hope in the end when there is nothing that you can do, why not go ahead and put your hope in God now in the middle when there is nothing else you can do? Because you don't control the economy, and you don't control what's going to happen. But I know the one who does. If your hope is going to be in God in the end when you have no control of what happens next, go ahead and put it in him now when you have no control over what happens next. Because we don't. He goes on to say, put their hope in God who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. You know, you don't have to give away your iPhone. You can even go out and buy a new one. You don't give away your cars. You know, that's one of the things that a lot of people make the mistake of thinking, that you know, if I put my hope in God, I have to give away everything I have. No, you don't. He gave it to you for your enjoyment. So we're not saying that. But let me ask you this. Why in the world would anyone for 1 minute put their hope in the provision when they could put their hope in the one who richly provides? Why would you give a minute or a day or a week or a lifetime spending your pursuit on something that you know is never going to be enough? Knowing that you'll never reach that magic number, knowing that what you are so desperately pursuing is not going to give you ultimate satisfaction. Why put your trust in the provisions when you can put it in the provider who richly provides everything? And a lot of people are surprised about this because they don't think Christians are supposed to enjoy stuff for your enjoyment. Now, if you doubt that God does richly provide for us, all you have to do is look at the cross. Because he gave his very best when you didn't want it and when I didn't want it. As a matter of fact, he gave his very best even before I knew it. That I needed it. He didn't send an angel and say, yeah, you guys are worse, maybe one of the lesser angels. He sent his son. And he said, I'm going to give you something that you might not ever accept. You may choose never to believe. You may never be grateful for this gift. But I love you so much, I'm giving you my very best. I'm not sacrificing something inferior for you. I'm providing the way of forgiveness and hope through my son so that you can have hope in this life and the one that is definitely going to come. So why not put your trust in the one who richly provides us everything for our enjoyment? So here's the question. Why put your hope in riches when you can put your hope in the one who richly provides? That's the question. And here's what I want you to do. I know this is lame, okay? I'm just telling you right now. I understand this is lame. But I want you to make a declaration with me right now, getting ready for the fact that maybe God will bless you. And I'm over time, aren't I? I got to move quickly. But I want you to make this declaration with me. Here it is. I'm going to read it for you first, and then you read it, okay? And if you do this declaration, you'll be a good, rich person. I will not place my hope in riches, but in him who richly provides. Now you read it, okay? I will
not place my hope in riches.
Okay, that's pretty good. I'm going to get you to do it one more time. This time, I want you to do it with a little bit of attitude. Okay? As a matter of fact, when you come out here, here's kind of like this. You know, you're going to say, I will not place my hope in riches, but in him who richly provides. And if you're a woman, you can go, riches. Probably hadn't done that since fourth grade, right? Okay, let's try again. Here we go. Ready? I will folks, I'm going to tell you something. That's a game changer. That's a game changer. It's life changing. And if you do that, what will happen? If God does bless you and keeps putting stuff in your hands, you'll never do this. Mine. You'll be a good rich person, not a bad one. So let me summarize what we've learned very quickly. We're done. Don't be arrogant. Don't put your hope in riches. Put your hope in God. So again, the question is, has your hope migrated? If your hope has migrated, you are going to begin to feel ungrateful, and you're going to begin to feel entitled, and you will. And when you feel entitled, you'll become more ungrateful, and you'll become greedy. And when you become greedy, greedy people, you know, they think everything that's placed in their hands is for their own consumption. You'll become greedy, and eventually that greed is going to show up on your face. You'll get ugly. It's going to show up in your attitudes. You'll be ugly. And you'll begin to hoard, and you'll begin to hold on to stuff that's not even yours. You say, whoa, wait, what do you mean by that, Pastor? What do you mean it's not mine? If you're a Christ follower, if you're not a Christ follower, none of this applies to you now. You can kind of tune out for just a minute, okay? But if you're a Christ follower, you know, God has set a standard on percentage giving. And he didn't set that standard by saying this. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to get all you can, spend all you want, and whatever is left over, I'll be glad to take. If you have anything left over, I'll, you know, just, you know, bring it to me. I'll be happy. No, he said, before you spend one penny, make sure you show me your gratefulness for my blessings by giving the first percentage of what you have, not the last, not the leftovers. And I know that none of us are rich, but I do know this, some of our hearts have already migrated. You know how I know this? I've been doing a study. And I am pretty sure with the average size congregation we have that not all of us are only living on $200 a week. Pretty sure of that. If you're trying to build an unscalable wall, you may never hit a bump financially, but you're going to hit a bump relationally. You're going to say, honey, I'm doing it for you. And she's going to say, no, you're not. You're doing it for you. You're going to say to your kids, honey, I'm doing it for you. Daddy's trying to build something so that you'll be safe. And they're saying, Daddy, it's not about us. It's about you. You don't care. We know that. You won't hit a bump financially maybe, but you will hit a bump relationally. Your family will say, you know, we hear what you're saying, but we don't believe it. And you'll be unhappy because you will have spent the productive years of your life pursuing something that you'll never obtain. And you'll get close, and you'll celebrate from time to time the big deal that came down, the special check that you got that you didn't expect to get. But then you'll start saying, but what if? What if? What if? And it will never be enough. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. So let me ask you, has your hope migrated? Are you trusting in what you have to make you happy? Or are you trusting in the one who richly provides everything for our enjoyment? Here's what I want you to do this week. I want you to answer that question, has my hope migrated? Now, most of us think that we know the answer to that already. And our first inclination is to say, not mine, Pastor. Absolutely not. But sometimes what we say we believe and what we do show two different things, don't it? Doesn't it? So in this area, the best measurement of whether your hope has migrated is this whole area of percentage giving. Just is. I think that's why God gave it to us. Are you living open-handed, or are you living close-fisted? Are you holding on to that which, if you are a Christ follower, is not rightfully yours even? Because it's supposed to be off the top. Or are you giving God token gifts? Or are you giving him what he more than deserves? Let me pray for us. Father, I pray. This is a tough message, a little bit longer than usual. And I thank you for everybody's patience with that. But it's an important message because it's so easy for our hope to migrate. Even in church, corporately, our hope can migrate into what we have in the bank rather than the one who provides what we have in the bank. But Father, I pray that you would work, and you work in my heart, in all of our hearts, and help us to answer that question honestly, because it can happen so subtly. And Father, we pray that if our heart has migrated, we'll turn around and we'll put our hope back in the one who provides, not in the provisions. Move now by your Spirit as we come to the conclusion of this time, in Jesus' name.